research was born out of a couple of things that Dr. Blakely, who's here in the front row, when we both worked at a center called the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M, which is not unlike the Marist College, which is a public policy and survey research institute. And there were a couple of things I think both of us were interested in. Is first that, you know, we've always been interested in these access issues. So over the years, and then secondly, this issue of devolution. And in speaking of that and how devolution, you know, turns over these responsibilities that were once federal responsibilities to local governments, either state or local governments. And I think, you know, what we've tried to do here is look at the consequences of that, and especially the unintended consequences of devolution. And I won't belittle, or I guess I'll build on the points that that Roy was talking about earlier. But again, if you think about transportation, if you did a literature review on access to care and transportation barriers, you would think that you'd hit the jackpot and you would find thousands and thousands of articles. But what you would probably find is that each article mentions transportation as a barrier to care. And that's all it usually typically lists. So we found over the years that transportation, and I think, again, building on what Roy was talking about, it's a very complicated issue and one that most researchers haven't studied other than just listing it as one of these access barriers to care. Again, just sort of building on the points of the urban and rural access, it's hard to overstate the access difficulties in rural areas, but urban areas are also areas where transportation is also quite difficult to come by. In fact, there was a presentation I attended yesterday, which was looking at access, urban access in San Francisco, a place that you wouldn't necessarily think that would have bad access issues, but the public transportation system there is just not designed around medical transportation access. That they, you know, it's built to take people downtown, but not necessarily to medical facilities. So that's something we need to keep in mind. And then I think that third point about the empirical evidence or the lack of empirical evidence. If you're at all familiar with Medicaid, especially Medicaid waiver programs in the United States, most of those programs had an independent access evaluation component to those. And a lot of programs sort of felt like they were studied to death, but this was not built into any of the SCHIP funding. There have been sort of sampled independent evaluations, but in Medicaid, for if you have Medicaid managed care, for example, each state was required to do an independent evaluation of access, quality, and Craig, help me, what's the third point? Access, quality, and cost effectiveness of those three issues, and that's not in the SCHIP bill right now. Oops. And again, you've probably heard talk about this devolution before, and again, think welfare reform here, right? Was it one that we're trying to experiment that states are these laboratories for a democracy? And that what can we do? We can experiment and bring about policy change by adopting those policies that work well in other states and other localities and bring those, because local governments and local providers know better than the folks here in Washington, for example. Again, there's some pros and cons to devolution. Yeah, I think the pro is that, again, local folks know how to design those programs in ways better than those do in Washington, for example. The cons are that do states have the personnel, information systems, facilities, and funds to manage such large-scale problems? And being one of those faceless state bureaucrats in the Medicaid office in Texas for a long time, I can attest to that fact. Again, problems may be exacerbated in poor states because of its reduced capacities to deal with important policy issues, and then the race to the bottom. And again, what we're talking about with the race to the bottom is that because there are no real benchmarks for this, that states have the incentive to do the least possible. So a low tax, low service state would attract fewer poor people. A high tax, high service state might attract more poor people. And thus, what happens is that high tax, high service states might drive out those taxpayers who are actually funding these programs, where low tax, low service states might keep from attracting more poor people. And again, there's a little bit of evidence to support both of these issues. I did make one mistake that I just noticed when I was working on this, but after I'd already loaded up these slides. And again, SCHIP has the options to design the programs, and you could either expand your existing Medicaid program, set up a separate state program, or establish a hybrid of these strategies. So actually, the 75% of all children are enrolled in the separate state model, not in the Medicaid expansion. So I apologize for that mistake there. And when we went out and were talking to states about why they chose the model that they did, a lot of states said it was simply the economics issue. And that, you know, Medicaid is a very, very comprehensive and expensive program to run. So the separate state model is built more around the like a Blue Cross and Blue Shield, the state employees insurance model. So it's not as comprehensive. It may not include things like transportation. It's not as comprehensive typically as a Medicaid program is. So if we think too about the history of non-emergency medical transportation, this was not actually in the Title 19 legislation that created Medicaid. It's only come about because of lawsuits. And again, the more and more we know that just by having insurance, that we don't necessarily equate that to access. So again, there's been a number of lawsuits across the states. A lot of these have come about in the southern states. For example, Texas is in an EPSDT lawsuit, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Mississippi. So there were these class action lawsuits that sued on the basis of access to care. It's not all about transportation, but transportation is a significant component of a lot of these lawsuits. So finally, this has become codified into the Code of Federal Regulations, and it states that states must ensure necessary transportation for recipients to and from providers. And I highlighted necessary there because the necessary is the operative word. And again, some states do a fantastic job in providing transportation to and from these non-emergency medical appointments, while other states don't do such a good job. But the states that are doing well are Vermont, Oregon, Washington. So those are the states that I think that are the leaders in this area. Again, so if we think about this non-emergency medical transportation in SCHIP, again, it's not a required component in the SCHIP program unless you've chosen a Medicaid expansion. So again, right, 75% of all SCHIP recipients are in this separate state program, so states are not required to provide non-emergency medical transportation, only if they've chosen the Medicaid expansion program. So most of the little states that didn't have a lot, a big population, so it made little sense for them to design a separate state program, Nebraska, Alaska, states like that have chosen for the Medicaid expansion program. States that have large populations, California, Texas, those are the states that have these separate state programs and thus do not require them to provide this non-emergency medical transportation. So why is this a problem? And again, when we ask states, said, well, what was the reason behind choosing this your program model? States said, well, it was an economics issue. So I went back and looked, and you may have read that a lot of states have not even come close to spending the federal allotments that they receive from the federal government on SCHIP. So if it's a question of economics, then why did you leave so much money on the table? So this is sort of an interesting question here. In about seven, between 1999 and 2005, the states had spent $7 billion less of what was appropriated for them for the SCHIP model. So in effect, states have left $7 billion of federal matching funds on the table. And some of these funds have been able to be spent. States like Rhode Island were able to take parts of that money that the states like Texas did not spend. So some of that has been turned over But most states have been unable to spend all of their matching funds. So a lot of money has been left on the table here, and I think that that is an important issue, especially in regard to thinking about the reauthorization of SCHIP. Again, it's not always the usual suspects here. So this map doesn't tell everything. Again, if you look at Washington and Oregon, they have not spent all of their SCHIP allotment. Again, not because they're bad actors here, but because they really had nowhere to go with their SCHIP programs. They already provided over and above services that most states still don't even come close to with their Medicaid and SCHIP programs together. So they're unable to spend their federal allotments. But other states, like Texas, haven't been able to spend all their money and has left about, I believe Texas had left about $1.6 billion of federal matching money. And again, also think about this, too, is that the federal matching rate for SCHIP is much better than it is for Medicaid. So, for example, Arizona gets about a 67% match on Medicaid, but in their SCHIP program, they get a 77% match on their SCHIP program. So, again, they get more money back from the federal government when they spend more money. And every state's SCHIP match is better than their Medicaid match. We also asked states, said, well, what are you doing about quality monitoring, or what are you doing about monitoring access? And some of you may be familiar with the Consumer Assessment of Health Plan Satisfaction Survey. This is an important instrument for lots of states that do quality monitoring. So they do this survey to look at access issues, satisfaction issues, those types of things. But I'll read you the question here and think about some of the problems with this question. So some health plans help with transportation for your child to doctor's offices, clinics. This can be a shuttle bus, tokens, vouchers, or a bus or taxi or payments for mileage. So in the last 12 months, did you call your child's health plan to get transportation for your child? And of course, it says yes or no. If no, you get screened out for the rest of those questions. So one, this question assumes that the HMO provides this type of benefit. And in fact, most non-emergency medical transportation is not the purview of the HMO. It is run as a separate program. It may be a brokered model where you would call a broker and they would help you arrange for your transportation, or the state somehow does it, like in Texas. So again, we've probably missed a lot of people just by asking the question this way. So, and then again, if in the last 12 months when you called to get help with transportation, your child's health plan, how often did you get it? And then in the last 12 months, how often did the help with transportation for your child meet your needs? So again, this probably isn't too much of a simple explanation for those transportation access issues. So I think, you know, we'd like to see some more questions about transportation in the CAP survey. And again, that's part of the supplemental item and not part of the core questionnaire. So it may not even be asked if a particular state chose not to ask those questions. Again, thinking about when I was talking about the Code of Federal Regulations and that transportation is a necessary service. So if we look at Medicaid SCHIP eligibility by age group, so this is Colorado, Florida, Mississippi, Texas, and Utah. And again, if you're at all familiar with Medicaid eligibility, so if you're an infant, 0 to 1, the federal government requires that you provide that up to 185%. And then when you're 1 to 5, it goes to 133%. And then 6 to 19, you go to 100%, right? So it kind of, the older you get, the more difficult it is to qualify for Medicaid. So what was the idea for CHIP? Was to even that out, right? So CHIP goes up to 200% to sort of even that out across the board. So what you see here is that for ages 1 to 5, right, so if you're 0 to 133% of poverty, you're eligible for non-emergency medical transportation. But if you become, if you make over that amount and then you are on the SCHIP program, you're not eligible for non-emergency transportation in these states. But also, if you become 6 to 19, Again, 0 to 100%, you're eligible for non-emergency medical transportation. But 100 to 200%, you're not eligible for emergency medical transportation. So what about someone who has siblings who may be 1 to 5 and then also has siblings who are 6 to 19? So the older siblings may not qualify for this non-emergency transportation benefit. So I think, again, this is sort of a violation of the spirit or the intent of that Code of Federal Regulations. If we think about some of the good things about devolution, here are two states. Again, here's Washington and Texas. And again, I just chose ages 6 to 19. But to show you an example of a state that's gone over and above with providing non-emergency medical transportation. So Washington goes all the way up to 250% with their SCHIP population. But everyone, including their Medicaid and SCHIP populations, are eligible for this benefit. And again, while they've told us that they're lightly used, they are accessed even at that income level. So in Texas, and again, I'm not here to pick on Texas, but only because I know Texas more than any other state. Here's the same issue here. So 0 to 100%, you're eligible because you're on the Medicaid program, but if you're above that poverty level, 101 to 200%, you're not eligible for non-emergency transportation. So again, to me, this violates the intent of that law. So what is the evidence on devolution? Again, I think it's good and not so good. What would we like to see? The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, developed an extended battery of questions for assessing transportation to the CAP survey. So again, since that's a widely used instrument and lots of states use that, we think that might be an effective way to get some better information on non-emergency transportation. And then again, not providing non-emergency medical transportation seems to violate at least the intent and spirit of that law. And again, think about poor people or those of low income and their access to transportation. The research says that the people of low income spend between 21 and 27, 28% of their income on transportation. So while they may not spend in the same dollar amounts, those of higher incomes, it's a larger proportion of their income. So that's a very important issue. Also, when we think about rising, you know, oil prices, I just, you know, out the door this morning, I noticed that oil was headed towards $100 a barrel. So again, I don't think we've ever seen what the sustained impact of rising gasoline prices will be on people's ability to access care. So that's going to be another important issue that I think is worthy of consideration.